okay? What are you guys selling?
You're drowning and I throw you a life jacket. Would you grab it? Yes, good. Pick up 200 shares. I won't let you down.
Pay this man his money.
Ask them how they'd like to see 30, 40% returns. What are they going to say? No? I don't want to see those returns?
Where's the money, Lebowski?
You're going to make a lot of money, right?
Be aggressive. Learn how to push.
Show him a 3% return, and I'll trust you to watch his kids for the weekend.
I'm a big fan of money.
Move around. Motion creates emotion.
I did not know that.
That's it. I'm done.
Rolling up by Stacey Jacks. I'm Tom Ali. This is Matt Weber on the board. SP Futures down 15. NASDAQ Futures down 153. This was after being up after the Fed utterances yesterday, and then they were up again last night. Now we're heading the other way. We had a big rally in gold last night, and that's petered out a little bit. Lou, how are you? Are you on first name basis with Chairman Powell?
No, I don't care about that guy.
I sort of don't either. I don't know how you lie on that grand of a scale, but that's
why I said the heck with him. They're all making it up, Chief.
It's making
it up as they go along.
I don't know, Lou. Obviously it's a common theme of mine to the point of being a broken record. But if you remember the '60s and the '70s, up to really '82, and you saw the amount of, I'll say, unevenness with the whole mess, the way how it played out, how you could possibly go stab that alligator again, I have no idea. And these guys have no fear whatsoever.
I've just basically thrown my hands up at what I see being rolled out right now in terms of government policy, in terms of the things that are being pushed by the new administration, and I'm fascinated by it, because you and I have had this discussion many times. I think we are looking at an ideological worldview that is driving this stuff, that is, again, as we've talked about many times, ignores reality, and I'm fascinated by the ability to ignore reality here, and it happens with our economic pronouncements and our economic policy. It's happening in defense. It's happening it's happening with our vaccine our response to the virus. It's amazing to me, but it's there.
I don't. I'm not sure where it's coming from. Well, I don't think it was, I'm. Excuse me if I'm missing my. I have so many guests, I get so involved in the conversation at the end of the week, I forget who I talked about to what. But that's not a good thing. But I think it might have been Carl last week, or was you, or was Brendan, one or the other. And I said, what? At least with the Republicans. I mean, I didn't like what their view was during the Iraq era and all that stuff. But at least I knew who they were. I knew who the men behind the scenes were. At least I had a pretty good idea. I mean, it was obviously the George Shultz group in Texas. It was anybody who was invited to the... Wait a minute, you got to come clean with this. Were you ever invited to the thing out in the Redwood Forest where all the Republicans get to go? What is that thing? The big picnic, or they have the big hunting lodge out there where they had the picture with Reagan and Nixon and all those guys sitting together and Bush? They all go to that big weekend once a year.
I could see Lou out there.
I could too. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I'm
aware that there is a conclave like that. It sort of mirrors what you get with the Democrats out in South Carolina or at Davos, but no, I don't know anything about it.
Yeah, because Man, you take that up. It's either the Sequoia.
Take down an elk or something?
It's like the Sequoia Club or the something something. It's one. I don't know who owns the damn place, but every year, every huge shot Republican. And the Bushes were behind the scenes, and what was the Cabot talked only to the lodges, and the lodges only talked to God. Remember that saying? And I mean, you kind of knew who the players were. And, you didn't necessarily like it all that much, or at least I didn't, especially when Rummy and those guys, the neocons, got involved. But, That was kind of later, but still,
you realize, of course, that mentality and that group is exactly who Trump overthrew and
right.
Ran roughshod over.
Well, that's exactly right.
The nomination.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm with you.
Okay.
But I'm saying when you say the group behind the Democratic Party, I have no idea who they are, Lou. I mean, it bothers the hell out of me, to be honest with you. I mean, at least I knew who the other guys were. You know, it was the Bush family, it was Cheney, it was Rumsfeld, it was that whole ilk. And at least I didn't agree with a lot of what they did, but they were Americans. They weren't all moving. They didn't live overseas. I mean, I didn't agree with them, but I understood where they came from, and it wasn't like I wanted to shoot any of them either. They were okay. I mean, I was a little more liberal than that, but maybe, you know, if you were old money like that, you'd be less liberal or something. I don't know, but I have no idea who's behind this drive in the Democratic Party. This is mayor. I thought it was a Gary mayor. I'm not sure who it was. Yesterday, they want this guy to resign because something happened. I'm not positive it's a Gary mayor, but somebody close enough to where he was on News Radio 78. And the guy's black. They want him to resign because there was something happened and a bunch of community groups, community guys, and, you know, preacher kind of guys, they all want to get on TV and talk about it. And he's like, oh, sure, they want their time in front of the camera or something like that. What, you need to resign because of that? I mean, what are we doing? I mean, you can't call a black crook a crook now? Is that the story?
Oh, that's, I mean, look at what's happening with, I think they're actually more blatant about it than even that. Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, excuse me, said he's going to appoint, if Feinstein resigns, he'll appoint a black female to the position. And I'm going, you're basically committing, in terms of employment law, you've basically committed an act of race and gender discrimination right there.
Oh yeah.
But this is blatant. The vice president, when Biden was in running, he locked himself into saying he's going to bring a black female on as his vice presidential candidate. The Democratic Party right now is in the throes of an identity politics. I don't know what the word is, mindset that drives every single thing they are doing. Instead of the kind of race blind, gender blind, decision making processes that we've always thought, when I say we, you, me, I mean anybody that came up living under the active enforcement of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, you and I always thought was the sort of a model. In other words, we don't care what color you are, we don't care what your gender is, we don't care now what your sexual identity or sexual preference is, in terms of making decisions about, you know, job qualifications or who should be a candidate or whatever. What we cared about was your merit, your character. Did you know what you were doing? This is all falling by the wayside, and it's falling by the wayside really quickly. So now, for example, you have and the kind of data mining that's going on with respect to people's past statements is I think at a point now where it's absolutely nuts. So you now have the, I think it's this Georgia police or sheriff's department official who tweeted out at some point, you know, get your t-shirt that says something like imported directly from China, you know, the Wuhan flu. I don't think that's particularly controversial, but there's somebody's latched onto it and is screaming about it now, saying, look, he's anti-Asian. And this goes back to your comment about let's go back to even something more basic. You've been aware for years, I'm sure, within the Chicago press, and I think it's a national trend, that the race of a perpetrator, if the race of a perpetrator was not identified in a news story right up front, it generally meant that the perpetrator was a minority.
Oh, absolutely.
If it was a white criminal, and I've never understood that. You know, why are we hiding that?
Say, Lou, 84% of the murders are black. So I guess you pull out the exception. could that be it? I mean, I don't know. I hope not.
I don't know.
All I know is I've met an awful lot of really nice white people, a lot of really crummy white people, and I've met really nice black people and really crummy black people. I mean, that's just the way humans are. That's why we're all equal, for God's sake, right?
But I mean, it's gone to the point now. So Piers Morgan, the British UK, America, or good morning, United Kingdom, whatever they have over there, is gets on and after the Meghan Markle Harry interview with Oprah, which I did not watch, but just reading about it, I kind of cringed. It sounds like a cringe fest all the way through. But he gets on and he says, you know, I didn't believe a word Meghan Markle said. And immediately tagged with a race issue.
Oh yeah.
And I mean, you know, this is because why? Because she's black and you're disagreeing with somebody who's African American. So therefore you must have a racial element, or there must be a racial element in your analysis. It's astounding. It's the flip side of everything that I learned in terms of not in terms of driving us toward a more equal society.
But every time
the colorblind society.
Every time you
do
something like
flip that on their head, the critical race theory says no. You take everything. You take all races. The first thing you consider, gender is the first thing you consider. And I've told people, if you run your business that way, you're going to be in violation of federal and state law. I promise you. I've got any number of court decisions that say if you're using race as a motivating factor, and let me tell you, if it's the first thing you consider in making an employment decision, if you're using it as a motivating factor, if you use race as a motivating factor in your employment decision, you're in violation of this federal statute, the Civil Rights Act. You're in violation of the Illinois Human Rights Act. You're in violation of the Colorado Human Rights Act. It doesn't matter. And yet, this permeates our business culture right now.
Well, I don't. I mean, it's if you look at it as, I don't know. You're right, Lou. It's gotten to the point where this Lincoln Yards thing, when Lori Lightfoot comes in to be mayor, of course, the Rahm father jams the thing through like 4 days before she gets in there. So, I guess she sort of had to agree, but she got boxed into a corner. I don't know what she would have done on her own, but of course, now this thing is. Only in Chicago, there's this whole area, for those who don't know what the hell I'm talking about, this area, actually, it's by me, that used to be, it's Goose Island, it's actually to the left of Goose Island, but it's an area that was always industrial in the city. I mean, Chicago, obviously, was an industrial city. And for years, the mantra was, we can't lose our industry, we have to make sure that you can't put condos up in these areas, they have to stay industrial, blah, blah, blah. Now, I don't know if people thought the handwriting was on the wall or whatever, but there was the Procter & Gamble plant became a Home Depot, and some of the trucking places are somewhat abandoned. So all of a sudden, this one group, what's the name of the guys, Manny? Oh, I forget the name. This one big company manages to jam his way through Rahm's brain and says, okay, well, why don't you make one of these TIF kind of things, and we'll develop this whole area. So they give these guys.
Is this on the south side by the river?
No. It's on the north side, right along the river.
Okay.
So it's between Elston Avenue and the river, but it crosses the river in a few spots. It's where the Morton Salt place is. And
okay.
It's all along that whole. It's really from Division to, I'm going to say Armitage, right, Matty? Or actually, it's further than Armitage. It's the Fortin, because it's the other side, Armitage too. It's where the steel company was.
Yeah, it's.
Well, it goes all the way to Fulton.
General Iron, where all that was, and along the river, sort of the industrial corridor there.
So this one company manages to get this dispensation or whatever. So they go around and I don't think the other people got the same zoning variance, so I think they had to sell to these guys for like less money. I'm not sure how that all worked, being Chicago. So, but of course, they're talking, 50,000 people there, which now is not going to happen because nobody's moving in the city. Well, it's 1.3% of the population last year, Lou. But there's not even a bus on Elston Avenue. There's no rapid transit. There's like nothing. There's Elston Avenue is down to one lane each way because Rahm's got some huge bike lane going each way. So how the hell are those people going to get to work? I have no idea. There's not like they've demanded there be an offshoot to the L to go over there. I mean, something intelligent where you actually plan a community. Nothing like that. So, Lori comes in and says, well, I've renegotiated the deal, and there's going to be more minority workers involved. Can you imagine me walking in and becoming mayor and saying, this is a crummy deal, but it's okay because I said you can only use, Irish, Irish plasterboard guys or something. What would possess me to ever say something like that at that level and not think I'd be laughed out of town?
The reason that you can say that is because the mainstream press gives top cover for this kind of narrative, and it's not just for things like this. It's all kinds of race or gender based kinds of initiatives.
Yeah, really.
Columbia University is holding and has since the early aughts or late 90s, is holding segregated graduation services.
Why?
Apparently there's one main graduation for it, but they segregate out your graduation services by race and by gender.
Why?
And I'm going, yeah, this wouldn't play well, but they can do it because nobody's going to, they're not subject to the kind of public opprobrium that if you stood up and said, okay, well, I'm going to have a whites only graduation service over here. It's a raging double standard, and it flies in the face of what I know the law to be, and it flies in the face of what we've again learned over the course of our lives is supposedly the appropriate response to an issue where somebody tries to take race into consideration in any kind of a decision like that.
But the weird part of it is, Lou, the stuff that I would do to even out, for lack of a better term, the education and the social stuff, is nobody's doing any of that. It's not like there's a lot of trade schools going up in the Tilden Techs and the CVS. It's not like we're putting money in to train people. It's not like we're having classes for people to learn how to, what it takes to, on the police test or fire test. We just want to rig the test. I mean, that doesn't do anybody any good.
That's exactly what it is. this has been developing. I first became aware of it when I started looking at cases involving public employee unions in large metropolitan areas, mainly fire and police, where the testing requirements were washing out a high number of minority applicants, and in the case of the firefighters, a high number of women, and so as you noted, the so-called affirmative action programs back then, and that's become a lost term, but the so-called affirmative action programs back then were designed to put a quota in place of a certain number of minorities or a certain number of women into these entities, these police unions or these employment entities. Okay, so that jump ahead 30 years. What we see now, you're hearing a lot of discussion about what's called equity in the social justice lexicon, and by equity, they don't mean the kind of things that you and I talk about, which would be okay, fine. We need to fix this at the beginning of the pipeline.
Right.
We need to get people trained up. Because we're not going to drop our standards. The standards that we use are the standards that we use, and we think they're accurate. We're not going to drop the standards. We're going to raise the level of performance of the people who are applying so that they can meet those standards. And so you and I look at the front end of the pipeline to fix the problem. But an equity analysis looks at the back end of the pipeline and says, you know, the only reason these people aren't meeting the standards is either A, the standards are racist, or B, the system that the pipeline that these people have been coming through is systemically racist. So we have to adjust the results so that we get everybody into these groups in some whatever the magic proportion is. And you can take your pick, whether it's the local population, it's a national population, whatever number they're using. But the point of an equity analysis now is to explicitly consider race or gender or whatever protected factor you feel is not represented, and take that and use that to make the decision at the end so that you can say, well, we don't have enough African-Americans passing the standard here, meeting the standard. So what we're going to do is we're going to ignore the standard, or we're going to artificially weight whatever some criteria that nobody can question us on, and we're going to use that as the determining factor. This is what's happening at Harvard and Yale and the other Ivies. And it's the subject of a number of pieces of litigation that are rolling forward here. with respect to black applicants versus, for example, Asian applicants. And so you find, notwithstanding the fact that, that Asian applicants are killing the SAT and the ACT, what's the first thing you do? Well, we're going to get rid of those tests.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then you go back, so we're not going to use those tests anymore because those are problematic because they actually do give us a very accurate measure of how well people are going to do in college. So we're going to ditch the tests. We're going to ditch those merit-based things. And then because the Asians, and it, again, this was explicitly aimed at Asian applicants at the Harvard case. In the case of Asian applicants, we're going to weight personality. I'm not making this up. We're going to weight personality factors. And because we consider Asian, we're going to, you know, it's a bigoted decision-making process because we consider Asians to be not quite as outgoing and not quite as, you know, social. And because they're all, you know, they're kind of a grind kind of culture, we're going to downgrade them on these personality
factors. They're bland because they study too factors. Much. They study too much. They're bland.
Well, that's it. I mean, yeah. this is actually part of the admissions process that came out of this litigation. And it was designed so that they could say, well, black people are just more fun to hang around than Asian people. So we're gonna weight the black people, you know, inordinately high on these social factors, and we'll keep the Asians low. And if we do that with enough push, we'll be able to make it look like, you know, African Americans on our merit system are high enough up that we can admit them. It literally, this was the discussion that was going on at Harvard during these cases in the admissions office, the contortion of their standards to do this. And this is the kind of discussion, for example, and this was a topic I wanted to raise today, that you see, for example, with the U.S. Army and its new fitness test. Somebody at the U.S. Army, TRADOC, or I don't even know if TRADOC's in existence anymore, but their training command, had the audacity to sit down and say, look, if you're in the infantry, it doesn't really matter what your job is, but if you're an infantry person, we're going to expect you to be able to perform certain physical requirements. And this was based on analysis of what we saw in Iraq and Syria and other places in Afghanistan. And it's a grueling physical test. And it's not, unlike previous tests, they didn't distinguish between men and women. They said, if you're going to be in the field, you're going to have to be able to do this. If this is part of your, if you're attached to one of these units, because we view soldiers as fungible, we can move them around wherever we want, you're going to have to be able to do these physical things. Well, that test is an ass kicker, to put it bluntly. And guess what happened? 65% of the women that took the test failed it. And I think something like, I don't know, maybe 15% of the men. I mean, it's a rigorous test. So now all hell's breaking loose in Congress because they're saying it's unfair, it discriminates against women. Again, completely kind of blind test. No exceptions for women. There's no exception for age. If you're a 45-year-old colonel, you got to be able to do this stuff, just like some 18-year-old or 19-year-old, basic enlistee. So what the immediate reaction is? Well, we have to readjust the standard because
they would for you and me, or for me for sure.
I'm sorry.
If they wanted me, they'd have to.
But you and I. This is what's interesting. Again, because of genetic differences, you and I could theoretically, anyway, train up to it, even at our ages, because we have more muscle mass. It involves, it involves dragging a 250-pound dummy or something like that, 50 yards. It involves, a heavy overhead ball throw, a weight like a medicine ball throw. There are a number of things that are designed to measure leg strength, core strength, upper body strength, and to push the soldiers to get to that point where they can do these things. And, I mean, what a surprise. The average woman significantly by genetics, significantly less muscle mass, significantly less endurance, they have a lot of trouble beating these tests.
But is it legit for the field, is what I'm saying. I mean, let's put it this way. Women have more of their body strength in their lower part than guys, and guys. I mean, if you're going to have a 25 pull-up test, you're not going to find too many women that can do that. But does anybody really need to do 25 pull-ups in the field? I mean, the stuff you're talking, I mean, you could rig it in such a way where only one side or the other. I mean, the question is the stuff legit?
Well, I again, the test is not some just let's set the numbers high enough so that we wash out the women. It's a test that said in combat, when our people, you know, are in combat operations on the ground in Iraq, in Afghanistan, these were the kinds of things that we saw soldiers having to perform.
Right.
The body drags, carrying large amounts of ammunition, and just so you know, rounds are heavy.
Oh, I imagine. So, yeah.
That's a lot of weight. It's a lot of weight to have to run around with if you're carrying 100 rounds of ammunition with you. They have to drag ammunition. They have to drag these packs. The average guy on a humping it into Iraq was carrying something like 60 or 70 pounds of gear. So we want our people to be able to do this, and we want them, even though we may rotate them into desk jobs, we want them to be able to keep this level of performance so we can pull them out of the desk job right away if we have to and put them in the field. Some of the adjustments on the tests are based on the what's called the MOS, the military operations specialty, are MOS specific, so that if you're a lawyer and you're not going to be seeing combat anytime soon, your standards are slightly lower. But again, this is not some made up number. It's based on these are ergonomic studies of this is how much you got to lift and this is what your core strength needs to be able to do this. So this test was put in after a lot of study, but it's a hard test, and it washes out a disproportionate number of women. It's not aimed to do that. The washout rates are based on genetic differences, but because the impact is such that at the end of the pipeline, you're not getting the same numbers that we want to see. We don't adjust the beginning of the pipeline, which is here's the physical training you need to undergo. That's too hard.
Yeah, but you didn't see.
We'll adjust the end result. Notwithstanding the fact that allegedly, I mean, if you believe the Army, this has an impact on combat effectiveness.
Well, I'm sure it does, but as you are no doubt a student of combat, I mean, the TV show, you never saw Sergeant Saunders telling Cage to grab the big, huge honking gun that Little John had to carry around, and you never saw Little John out on point. Just saying. There's always been people with different talents.
But if you're assigned,
I understand.
So here's the thing.
I'm just giving you grief. We got to go to break, but we'll continue. SB Feeder's now down 18.75. Wow, what a difference 12 hours make. We're celebrating St. Paddy's. We're up last night pretty good. Golden Silver was rallying, and now they're not. A lot of changes. We'll be right back. Stacks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Blowing up picks, stocks and jocks. I'm Tim Howley. He's Mr. Matt Weber. Mr. Lou Michael's with us, and just sitting here watching this stuff and sort of seething at our regulators and how a trade I missed there. Because of them. S&P futures down on 2650. Ouch. NASDAQ down 224. I had this feeling with all the good news yesterday and last night that somehow or another people are going to reread what the guy said yesterday, and then the reread wouldn't act so good. Dow, however, is like unchanged because we got some stuff that's up in the Dow. We got Goldman Sachs up 465. Go figure. JP Morgan up 241 as we're just keep, no matter what, the first job of the Fed is to feed money to banks, it appears. Anyway, how's that for a shot? With DAX up 153, that's 1%. FTSE down 14.2%. CAC around up 3, call that flat. Not sure exactly whether the DAX is at actually a record high, with interest rates still minus 0.3. I don't know, I have problems with that. Nikkei up 302. These guys must have closed while we were still up. That's 1%. Shanghai up 17.5%. Hang Seng up 371, that's 1.3%. Just a way of, yesterday we were up 189 in the Dow, we're up 11 in the S&P and 53 in the NASDAQ. This is while Powell was talking. 10-year, get a load of this, 1.75. Manny, my 2% by Labor Day, it's going to be there by Memorial Day, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Bund, positive 0.8 to minus 0.25, it's as high as we've seen that in a long time. Japan, however, not really going that route, still 0.10. That's where it's been like forever. UK is 0.90, which is up 7 basis points over there. Oil, up 3 cents, so call that flat at 64.63. Brent, 67.94. Natural gas down a penny, 251. Arbob up a penny, 206. Gold, which was up like 25 hours last night, it's only up $3 now, 17.31. Silver was up like 60 cents, now it's up 17. 26.23. Copper up a penny to 4.13. And last but not least, crypto up 168 to 50,028. I would have thought that would have been doing better this morning after yesterday's events with the Fed. Matty, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
37 minutes past the hour. Good morning to everyone out there. We're looking good so far on the area expressways, roadways, and tollways in spite of some rain and high winds in the area today. No issues coming in on the Edens or Kennedy. Eisenhower and Stevenson looking good. Same for the south side. Lakeshore Drive is all quiet, too. A couple of crashes off the expressways out in the suburbs. Western suburbs, Ontarioville Road at Lake Street, there's an accident involving a semi that has crews on the scene. And then up in Lake County, Washington Street on the eastbound side at South Greenleaf Avenue, there is an accident as well. But everything else is looking good out there. Weather today, not so good. Week of rain and cold and clouds continues before we warm up this weekend. Today, overcast skies, rain in the forecast, wind gusts of up to 40 miles per hour and a high of just 42. Right now it's cloudy and 38 degrees downtown. For our Phoenix listeners, sunshine with a high of 82 today. Right now it's mostly clear and 48. In sports, the Bulls had an 18-point lead at halftime and looked like they were going to cruise to their third straight win, only to surrender a 17-0 run in the fourth quarter. as they fell to the Spurs down in San Antonio last night, 106-99. Blackhawks were off. They're back in action tonight down in Tampa as they'll take on the Lightning. That's a 6 p.m. puck drop Chicago time. And the first four in the NCAA tournament tips off this afternoon, Chief. There'll be four games tonight before the rest of the field tips off tomorrow morning. Of course, the tournament is one day later than normal this year. Texas Southern and Mount St. Mary's get the action started at 4:10 Central Time. That's a battle of 16s for their play-in. And then the 11-seed matchup is at 5:30 between number 11 Drake and number 11 Wichita State. That should be a good one. Both those teams won a lot of games this year. At 7:40, it's the other 16-seed matchup, Appalachian State versus Norfolk State. And then the headliner tonight is the other 11-seed play-in game, and it's number 11 UCLA versus number 11 Michigan State. And that's going to tip off late tonight, 8:57 p.m. Central Time. Chief?
I have not seen UCLA play. Are they any good, or is Michigan State the favorite there?
I think Michigan State is a Michigan State's a 2-point favorite over UCLA, but they're pretty equal. They're both 11 seeds.
What time is that game? Like 11 o'clock?
8:57 p.m. Central Time.
I'm going to try and watch.
I want to note that, excuse me, I was greeted when I called in this morning by Maddie saying, "Hey, sorry, your Dukies didn't make the tournament," and which of course meant that Maddie was not sorry that Duke didn't make the tournament.
Well, you guys bailed on the rest of the season.
But I mean, I can't. I resigned myself, you know, a month ago to the fact that the team could not put together more than you know, one or two games of good play at a time. It actually looked like they were starting to gel during the ACC tournament. And Krzyzewski said, "The only way we get in is if we either win the tournament or make a very convincing showing there." So they couldn't do that because of COVID. But I mean, that team, I'm sorry, that team didn't deserve to go on to the tournament, as far as I'm concerned. And you know, they had a rough run. Their number one guy dropped out, what, back in January, Maddie?
Yeah, Jalen Johnson.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm sorry, the team, team didn't cut it this year, and that's an issue. They had a down year.
First time since 1976 that both Duke and Kentucky are not in the tournament.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's been 25 years for the Irish girls. They didn't make it.
I mean, the guard is gonna change at some point. And I mean, you know, Carolina had a down year a couple of years ago, and it just happens. I heard Jay Billis, who I admire tremendously as a sports commentator, say, you know, the expectations for programs like Kentucky and Duke are so high that when they have a year that looks a lot like the year that a normal college team has, which is, you know, fighting for that berth and struggling to put a consistent effort together, when they have a normal year like that, it's considered a tremendously down year for them, and that's I think he's right on that.
Well,
he is, but the difference is that Kentucky and Duke still have, you know, 7 or 8 McDonald's All-Americans on their roster, whereas no one else gets those kids, and so people love the fact that Kentucky finished, you know, 7-13 or whatever they were this year, in spite of you know, a top 3 recruiting class yet again.
Well,
I think that's an excellent point. We talked what last year about how in the world do you lose? Do you go out in the round of whatever it was, 16, when you've got Zion Williamson playing for you?
It's crazy. Yeah.
Well, it's true.
So I don't. I think Krzyzewski has, and I don't know if he's capable of doing this, but I think he needs to rejigger, I think, his strategy with respect to the one and dones, because I just don't think whatever his program is, and he had some success with it, but whatever his program is, I think it's not well adapted to the one and done player. And I think that's why you haven't seen the kind of sort of top level performance that Duke fans are accustomed to.
He teaches like they're still going to be there for a while, and they're not.
That's exactly right, or at least I think that's what he's doing. Whatever it is, I don't think it benefits his program or his coaching philosophy to have people there that are only going to be there for a year, and it they don't pick up the stuff fast enough. I don't know. I defer to Matt. He follows this more closely than I do, and to you, Tom. I don't know whether you can win with a team of guys who you deliberately say I'm not interested in a one and done player. I want the guys who are going to be here for at least two and better, you know, 3 or 4 years. I don't know if you can win with those guys anymore.
All you have to do is look at Virginia in your own conference. They don't ever have any one and duns, and they're competing for national championships every year now. And this year, because of COVID, they had a couple of pauses, and so they had a down year by their standard. But they're still a 4 seed, and still, you know, a very scary team in the tournament. But there's a handful of teams. I would put Virginia in that category. I would say Gonzaga is in that category.
That
occasionally will have a one and done, but for the most part, they have guys that are there for 2, 3, 4 years, and they're consistently good. But it is hard. I mean, you know, if you don't, when you have an opportunity to get the 5-star talent that, you know, by the time they're in, it's March, they're really, really good, like Kentucky in most years, like Duke in most years of late, it's hard to turn that down when you can get those kids.
Well, you also know that the transfer coming in is seeming to be a bigger and bigger thing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's huge for Michigan. They had a core of really good players, but they lost their point guard, and then they plugged in that kid from Harvard. I'm drawing a blank on his name, but he had a year of eligibility, got his degree from Harvard, transferred to Michigan because Ivy League opted out this year for basketball, and he's been so good for them because they just plugged him right in, and they're a 1 seed.
Would he have been able to go anyway because of the graduated?
Yes, he would have. But I think the fact that they weren't playing at all, he absolutely was like, I'm, you know, getting out of here.
So the question is, and I've had this discussion with friends here in the red hot basketball town of Denver. how much is the NBA driving this? Obviously, the NBA was driving the one and done push, but is the NBA satisfied with the one and done, the quality of the one and done talent? It still takes, at least in my opinion, it still takes a while to develop these kids. Now Williamson, in my mind, is an exception, but he's a physical, you know, a physical aberration. Doesn't it take a longer? Doesn't it take a while to develop these kids? Could the NBA make the live with the fact that these kids are likely to be much better players after a couple of years in college, and more importantly, some maturity?
Well, that's the thing. Do you really want a bunch of 18-year-olds hanging around with Dennis Rodman?
No, and I think it's an exceptional kid surrounded by exceptional people who can take that level of stardom or that level of money or whatever or adulation and put it off to the side and say, you know what, as a 19-year-old, I got to get better as a basketball player, and I got to grow up, and I got to understand the work ethic and everything else. And I think it takes an exceptional kid to do that. And I don't know if NBA clubs are in the character developing business.
Well, with that schedule, I don't see how you can be. I mean, the Bulls tried that when they had Eddie Curry. Of course, he had with the heart rhythm problem. But who was the other guy? Just retired.
Tyson Chandler.
Yeah, no, he was never.
He played like 20 years in the league.
He was never any good on the Bulls. I mean,
well, he was really good in portions of his career.
Oh,
but,
sure, yeah.
But for the Bulls, he was just serviceable. I mean, he was really young.
Well, yeah, he just never. Maybe just the
I do actually think he was good on the Bulls, but he was a defensive and rebounding guy, and then, you know, a rim protector that could basically finish at the rim, and that was it. Later in his career, he developed somewhat of an offensive game, but he never really had the skill set to be a great offensive player.
But they ended up with two or three guys at the same time, and that I think you absolutely can't do on the NBA level. I mean, you don't get the practice. Right. I mean,
I wonder. I mean, I think again, it obviously depends on the nature of the player. These decisions always do. But I think it's you're really running against the grain. And maybe the NBA, the answer is the NBA D League, where they can, you know, developmental leagues where they can take guys right out of high school and who aren't interested in academics or anything else except hoops, and take those guys and develop them up. But again, I think the environment of the average college campus is better for development on these kids than the average environment around an NBA basketball team.
Well, I mean, you shouldn't have to masquerade as a college student to become a professional basketball player.
Well, I think you're both right. I think, but I believe that Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA, is going to get rid of the 1 year out of high school requirement and going to allow players to come straight out of high school, knowing that they're trying to build their developmental league anyway. And like Chief said, you know, there's no reason to fake being a college student when you have no interest in going to class. You might as well get paid, and if you're not quite ready to play on the big stage, then we have a developmental league for you, just like, you know, baseball.
Just like baseball, yeah. So let me switch gears slightly, staying on athletics. I just wanted to talk about the story that I read this morning that the Bears had offered the Seahawks 3 first-round picks, 2 starters, and apparently a couple of bridges across the Chicago River to the Seahawks in exchange for Russell Wilson.
Well, the last thing they want is the number 1 pick. They have to pay people. They don't want to do that.
Well,
so they want to get rid of all number 1 picks.
Yeah, and Seattle still said no because it wasn't enough.
Yeah, I mean, I continue again to be astounded at the mindset, and I disagree with it. I disagree with this mindset. Obviously, I continue to be astounded at the mindset that you should trade away the future of your football team or the ability to build your football team around a single "quote unquote" superstar, and I mean, I think Wilson's a very good quarterback, but I don't think he's worth 2 first round draft picks. Never mind 3.
Well, as Seattle,
Lord knows what else they were throwing at him.
If Seattle degraded this year, they didn't win, and the Bears are way more degraded than Seattle. So why makes you think the Bears are going to win with the guy a year older?
Well, I mean, again, this goes back to my whole bit about people just ignore context. And the context is the 10 other guys you've got out on the field with that quarterback. And my offensive line bias is showing here.
Well, yeah.
You need a good supporting cast. I mean, the Super Bowl proved this dramatically. I don't care if you're Patrick Mahomes and you can throw, you know, 60-yard passes with your knees 2 inches off the ground as you're falling down. You're not going to win that way. If the kid is put under that kind of pressure all game, they can't win. You're not going to win. You go from a great football team to a very mediocre football team very quickly.
They went 17-2. I would call that winning.
Well, they were.
Seattle went 12-4 and won the division. I would call that winning. They didn't win the Super Bowl. Only one team wins the Super Bowl. But the fact is,
no. But they didn't win. What happened in the Super Bowl, Maddie, was the cast around Mahomes disappeared.
He lost
their
his
offensive
left tackle.
Line was wrecked, and so I'm a believer. I'm a believer in what the Baltimore Ravens did. What was it back in 2002, where they had that nitwit as a quarterback, but they had a fantastic defense and they had an offense that was stacked with people that could play football well enough that they didn't need to have the quote savior quarterback sitting back there, making plays.
There's no doubt that there are examples here and there. Like you brought up one from 20 years ago, where yes, you can win a Super Bowl with an average or bad quarterback if you have that Ravens team had the best defense of all time since the '85 Bears. Like that was
had a great defense. But Matty, Tom Brady was not a great quarterback.
Well, I would highly disagree with that. This year he was not necessarily great by his standards, but he was still very good.
Yeah, he was still good.
The fact is, the teams that win consistently, that make the playoffs every year, I mean, you look at them, I mean, Seattle, like you talked about, Green Bay, New Orleans with Drew Brees, Brady with the Patriots forever, Mahomes with the Chiefs, they all have great quarterbacks. Now, only one team can win the whole thing. And yes, there are aberrations, but there's basically 5 great quarterbacks in the league, and if you don't have one, the thought process is you'll pretty much give up anything to get one, knowing that you can build around him, and it might take a year or two. But if you don't have one, none of it matters, because you're not going to win it.
You can't build around him. You give up all your draft picks.
You're not giving up all your draft picks. You're giving up a first-round pick for 3 straight years. You still have a second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh. You still have free agency.
Yeah, but the value of those guys I do not believe in the superstar savior at any position, but again, we're in the entertainment business, so you know, we want the entertaining guy up there in front, but I simply don't buy the idea that you would trade this much, and again, I'm I'm coming out of a background where I watched the Minnesota Vikings blow themselves up for Herschel Walker.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I would never do it for a running back. We're in complete agreement there. In fact, I wouldn't do it for any position on the field unless it was a top one of these, you know, if it's Aaron Rodgers, if it's Patrick Mahomes, if it's Russell Wilson, I would consider doing it. But you're right, I would never do it for a running back, for anything like that. You can always find those guys.
Also,
the first-round picks, the Patriots never had first-round picks. They couldn't care less about a first-round pick.
Actually, they had more than you think.
And when they were drafting first-round picks, it was the 32nd pick or the 31st pick. It doesn't matter.
Hey, I need to get your opinion on something here a little before.
If you look at the stats on draft picks, the guys most likely to play for you are, and the difference is dramatic if you look at the numbers. The first round picks are dramatically higher in terms of their viability in the National Football League than even second and third round picks. Every now and then you'll pull somebody up, but the first round picks, if you're giving up first round picks, you are giving up almost guaranteed starters for your team.
Yeah, if you can't find a guard or something in the first round that's going to start for you,
about that, but you also have to realize it's a chicken and the egg thing. If you draft a first-round pick, you better start him. Even if he sucks, you're going to start him just to show that
if you're the Bears, you're not paying him to stand on the bench.
You're going to give him every opportunity to start.
Yes, but these guys, if you look again, looking at history, these guys historically start, and they start consistently.
They should be a step
first
above.
First round pick will start the first year maybe, or maybe even the second year. But after that it starts floating away, and I think Trubisky may be the model.
Well, so what if he goes somewhere now and is good? Hey Lou, I gotta drag you off this for a second because I got this article here that I sent around to everybody that has got your name written all over it. I gotta ask you this question because you're my expert on you know, China, we know we want blue jeans $10 cheaper and we're willing to do anything to get them. We don't care if there's slave labor involved or Nikes. But the simple fact is we also think we got people beating up Chinese people even though they've been here for 40 years, which is fairly ignorant. So we've got this problem with China. And now I'm looking at this article here by, and I'll give you the name because it's pretty darn good. Yen Ni Li, obviously an Asian lady, and she writes this thing regarding China is building up its ability to weaponize trade, new report says. This is a spectacular chart here. And this is from 2000 to 2020. Foreign-owned base metals and gold companies in Oceania. Now, I guess Oceania is, what, the whole eastern part of the Pacific? Is that the idea?
It's the Pacific around from Japan westward to about Hawaii.
All right, that whole area. Well, it says here here's the rest of the world in these base metals and gold companies in 2000 were 26.6% of the investment, and now they're 28. Okay, the U.S. was 22, and now it's 10. China used to be 0 in 2000, and now they are 22.6. There's 59 companies now in that area that are in base metals and gold and probably some oil too, I would guess, but I'm not sure, that are now Chinese companies, and their dramatic moves to lock in the oil and the metals that they don't have, even though the country's huge. I still got to believe it's somewhere in China there's some oil. I haven't found it yet. I mean, the place is darn big, but there's got to be a Bakken in China someplace, but maybe not. Anyway, so I mean, what they're doing is, the only other country that's gone up is UK from 8.4% to 9.2, so that's kind of a baby move up. But Canada was 17.7, now they're 14.2. These guys are doing everything they need to do for the long run. While we're sitting there arguing, just to say earlier, one thing I wanted to mention, well, I'm not a big Bible dude, but all these people that call somebody else out for one statement they might have made 20 years ago is, did they read the part about, you know, he's without sin, cast the first stone? Can anybody have them read a tape of what they said 20 years ago and not find a screw-up in there somewhere?
This is, I'm just going to say, and let's get back to this metal discussion, because this was something that was huge during the apex of the Soviet Union. You have to understand that the social justice movement, as we see it developing in the United States, is a substitute for religion. This is a religious faith. It is a faith-based movement. It's not based on numbers or science or anything else. It is a faith-based movement. And if you look at it that way, the zealotry and the bigotry and everything else that you see coming out of a lot of these folks begins to explain itself.
Yeah, but the Catholic Church, if you bleeped up, you went to confession and you were welcomed back in the place. They didn't ban you from your job for the rest of your life because you made one statement that was lousy or grabbed one tush.
No, but I mean, you just got to understand that anything that smacks of any consideration of race or gender identity that steps outside the very narrow boundaries of this social justice hierarchy is considered to be heresy. Catholic Church didn't forgive heresy very well, and so that's what these people look at. And I mean, that's the way, I think that's their worldview. But let's get to your strategic minerals thing, because this, so back in the 1970s and the 80s, the Soviet Union was heavily involved in trying to develop relationships with countries like South Africa, notwithstanding the fact that they were obviously, you know, one of the most bigoted places on the planet. And the reason for that was what was referred to then as strategic minerals, things like chromium and rare earth metals and things like that. And when I say rare earth metal, I don't mean a thrash rock band, from the 1960s.
Hey, they had some good songs. They had some good songs.
Yeah, that's some good stuff. What you see China doing now, and again, the Chinese, the Chinese, very much like the Russians, look at their business sector as an arm of the government, an arm of their political sphere. Their goal is to make this the Chinese century. They believe they're entitled to it. They believe that the only reason this hasn't happened before is because of the bigotry of Western nations keeping them down, and that this is their entitled space. And so they are moving to occupy that space. And one of the ways you do that, one of the ways you make sure your economy is running effectively, is you can use, for example, slave labor, which they are, we now know, with the Uyghurs and other ethnic minorities. And then you, by expanding your economic reach so that you are looking, 5, 10, 15 years down the road and saying, we're going to be able to plan so that we always have access to certain minerals, to oil, to whatever. The Belt and Road system that they're developed across Asia, the economic ties they're developing and they've developed with Africa, all of this is aimed at promoting the Chinese state and Chinese culture, so that when push comes to shove, they could simply go to some African nation where they want to put troops and say, if you don't let us stage troops out of your country, we're going to turn your telecom system off. Or we're going to stop power generation at the dam we built. Or we're going to shut down the airport that we just
built. It's a playbook that we had, right?
Yeah, except that we weren't doing it quite as directly as
Well, and, we import-export bank. We used the import-export bank for that. I mean, Pullman did a lot of building refineries and stacks or chimneys, places just to get in and get people used to doing business with us. I mean, we did some of that. Lou, we got a dash, but
we did do that kind of thing because we understood that influence was important. But this is a lot more organized. And
agree. I mean, we took the benefits of it, but we didn't direct people to do it. I mean, kind of a different story, like you're saying.
And I mean, to the extent that we try to stay out of the politics stuff, except in extreme cases, I think that was, I don't think we were quite as insidious as what we see the Chinese doing right now. However, Chile, Honduras, Iran.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a long time. Those were more than a generation ago. But we certainly played that card when we thought we had to. Certain elements of the government played that card when we have to.
People don't change.
Certain elements in the Chinese government. I think there's only one element.
People don't change, Lou, and the little tricks don't change. What can I tell you? Especially economics. S&P futures are down 22 now. We're back a little bit. Nasdaq futures down 200. We'll be right back, Mr. Dangenitis.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Hear ye, hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control!
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
There's something happening here.
Well, and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Holly. He's Mr. Matt Weber on the board. S&P futures down 22.25. NASDAQ futures down 200. It says here, Fed Chair Powell is a maestro calming markets when there could have been chaos. This is by Patty Dom is her name. Were you calm? Did you have your bottle of Jack Daniels in front of you, Dan, and not have to open it, or what?
I didn't have to open it. I was paying attention very carefully, and I guess it's, you know, it's nice to that they're doing what they're saying they're doing, going to do. You know, that I think the shift in sentiment a little bit is rather than trying to predict, let's look at outcomes rather than looking at the future. And I think that may be a, you know, sort of a change of sentiment, but it may also be a change of sentiment that's temporary based on what we've been through over the last year. Very interesting that it's been earnings week, earnings month, if you will, over the last few weeks, and I've had a couple of companies respond in a similar fashion where they're either not talking guidance or they're talking guidance very generically and, kind of relying more on what is happening currently, and they want to make decisions based on current outcomes and current data. So that seems to be the theme, and I mean, I'm on board with the fact that they're not too concerned about inflation, and that what they're referring to as sort of this temporary blip is, I'm not sure I 100% agree that this temporary run-up here in rates is temporary. I think that this could be longer term, and there's a lot of factors that are going to impact that over the next year. But I will give it to them that it's, you know, in the very short term time horizon, like the next few months, I'd be on board with what they're saying. I just think over time, I'm not sure whether that those inflation scares or whether those higher rates are not going to continue. I think they will continue. It's just at what pace.
Well, we went from no inflation, can't get to 2% to we're over 2% to don't worry, it's transitory to we don't really care what the number is, we're going to keep buying. It's kind of a big move in 60 days or 90 days.
It is, yeah. And there's also, you know, this additional stimulus that literally, I mean, yesterday was being dumped on or you know, was being received by many, and that is going to continue to have an impact. And then, you know, hearing, yeah, we'll put as much into the system as we possibly have to keep things going. And, you know, I think they did, you know, he did talk as to the different sectors or the segments of the market that are, you know, vastly different in terms of some areas have seen nice growth over the last year and are going to continue to see that growth, and then some areas are playing catch up. My concern is just that they're talking a little bit about apples and oranges. If you're talking about, you know, sort of an unskilled worker trying to get your labor force back, and you're talking about an unskilled worker that may be a waiter or a waitress, at a restaurant, you know, and possibly say a student or a part-time worker, that's quite a bit different than talking about skilled laborers, whether they be adept in manufacturing or in the service sector. So there's, you know, I think we can get up to speed a lot quicker should, say, restaurants start opening and people start going out more sooner than we expected. I don't think that's going to be as hard a, you know, and it's not going to take as long to get back to a higher level of employment. My question in all this, that's my concern, I should say, is just that we don't have another situation like Greece where the benefits that were being received by the individuals, the potential labor force, potential people coming back, are actually higher than what they were receiving before, and they decide, hey, I'm not being paid to go back. So it's not about a career, it's about a part-time job. So why not just keep collecting the unemployment? So that's a little bit of the concern that I have. I don't know whether that's too early to have that concern, but that would be a bigger concern for me than wondering whether we're going to have enough people to fill, you know, to move inflation back, I mean, move employment back to the pre-pandemic levels.
Well, why are we, I'm sure you get a bazillion emails too, but I get stuff from kind of both sides. And the interesting part here is that some of my people absolutely on the right are now, without even knowing it, their content is flipping themselves to the left because they're pointing out exactly how non-democratic, for lack of a better term, these policies are.
Right.
And which is totally bizarre when you think about it. I mean, everybody, you just said, I've heard, you know, in, well, let's say a couple of coffee shops, might have been a couple of bars, where you hear people talking, and everybody will say these bleeps are making more in unemployment than they are at their jobs, so they're going to stay home. And I actually know a few people that have done that. So yeah. It's not like it isn't true. But we somehow, it's not published that there's people at the airlines that are making full pilot salaries, they haven't flown in a year. And, you know, one of the ladies downstairs who works, in one of the emporiums is a flight attendant, and she's been paid since last March. She hasn't been on a plane. Now, you know, you don't get your bonuses for flying more miles in a week and those kinds of things, so you're probably not making the same amount as you did when you were working. But, I mean, nobody points at their finger. They look at the unemployed kid down the block sitting on a sofa watching God knows what, and saying that guy should be at work. Nobody says, why exactly is the president of United Airlines getting a full salary? I mean, it is amazing how we turn this. But now the weird part is the emails and stuff I'm getting, they're serious right-wingers bitching about this because it's the Democrats that are doing it. I mean, if you look, matter of fact, well, the one I got this morning, if you take every poor person in the country and divide it into the thing, you could send the person like a $25,000 check and he wouldn't be poor anymore.
Right.
You mean, it's just like, you know, Johnson's war on poverty. If you looked at the amount of money divided by the amount of poor people and sent them a check, you wouldn't have any poor people. You know, all these people get the money along the way. It's so bizarre that you don't even know what stripes people are anymore because the one side's giving away money to, I think the businesses are just winning no matter what. And the big ones, right. and they're bigger than us. Let's put it that way. I mean,
absolutely.
And I don't know. To me, the idea that there can be a little inflation. I'll ask you. I mean, just definition. This guy lobs out there. This guy Powell, who I can't want to listen to the guy. I mean, when you start saying something is transitory or temporary, okay, used cars. I'll use that example. We're up 11.5% last year. 11.4. Does that mean they come back down this year, or now the 11.5 is the new level we start from?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in your camp in terms of not agreeing with the transitory comments. In other words, thinking that there's only going to be transitory doesn't happen. It's gonna be the new norm, if you will, or it's gonna be a continuation of where it was from last year, because there isn't just this short spike in, you know, whether it be auto sales. I know boat sales are really big. I was talking to a client the other night who was moving into a larger boat, and you know, it's hard to get boats, and there's certainly inflation, if you will, in boat prices. That's going to happen across, but it's continuing to happen across the board in other assets like housing.
There's still strong demand. I don't know how what it takes in terms of interest rates, what level of the 10-year is going to really start slowing that down. But I think we have a lot of people buying, for example, from the Northeast who have or paying cash. So I don't know if the mortgage issue is going to really impact housing. And then, you know, people are paying the extra money right now for food and gas. It's, you know, that people have been able to save some money and they have this additional liquidity right now. Jobs are opening. And I don't know whether it's going to be transitory. I think this is going to be, it's going to be an upward, we're going to have an upward slope here, but it may be, there might be some dips in the slope. But I wouldn't think that's going to be a transitory movement up to 2 or 2.4, and then that dips back down to 2 or under 2 over the next year. That I don't agree with. I think we're going to see this increase. And as you're saying, it's going to be an increase that has already been part of a curve, if you will, or a movement, if you will, prior to the pandemic.
Well, I'm not even sure. Last night we were talking about someone who said, Aaron, Chief, you're always on this inflation thing. And I said, you know, it's funny, I used to have I worked at Pullman. I was the inflation guy, for what I call a better term. I wasn't the person who designed the stuff. I just was the guy who had to do the calculations because I was a young rummy. But the weird part was you could actually use the CPI back then, Dan, as a, I mean, if you and I, because I think we're both bright enough that if we did a long-term contract with, say, Mehdi Weber's firm, that we were going to sell them, you know, God knows what, we're going to deliver houses, you know, at a certain price, that we'd have to have an escalation clause in there. Yet right now, the way these people, and I'll use the term, are lying about the consumer price index, I don't know what we'd use. I mean, what if we put a consumer price index in there, and in the last year the price of lumber is like doubled? Well, we're not getting helped out by the 2% these guys are admitting to. I mean, we can't even use the government numbers now and keep ourselves right afloat. I mean, the lying or the misrepresentation is reaching a point where you can't even use the numbers for normal business, I don't think.
Yeah, I think the accuracy of the numbers is definitely questionable and will continue to be questionable. And getting that information, getting the details of that information is seemingly more difficult than it has been in the past. So, and I don't know whether that's to justify or not to justify the additional spending. But it does make it more difficult for us to have a clearer picture of you know, direction of rates and direction of inflation here. I think we're probably in the same camp and thinking that there will be some tick up, there will be some continued tick up in inflation. It will be gradual. It may have some bumps, you know, certainly overnight. It seems like, you know, overnight meaning last night, it seems like it was more than gradual.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not sure if that was in response to Powell's talk yesterday or whether this is just the direction that we're going in. You know, the thing that happens, though, and I think is something that you might also be alluding to, but I've been looking at is, if you look at what's happened even just year to date to Treasury bonds, U.S. Treasuries are down 4% year to date. And that may not seem like a lot, but for, we've seen gradual increases in Treasuries over the last decade, and now all of a sudden a 4% decline. 4% decline in equities doesn't mean anything, but a 4% decline in bonds in such a short period of time does mean you might have to take a clearer look at your at your allocation, asset allocation, and how much exposure you want in fixed income or where you want that exposure to be. I think the global aggregate bond index is down 3.7%, so if you include treasuries, I mean governments and some other fixed income instruments, high yield I think was the only one that was positive, up 0.4%. And our area of the market is short-term high yield, which has done better than that. So, really, this is a time when you really have to be, as a bond investor or as an investor who wants to allocate money to fixed income, you really do have to be concerned about higher rates and inflation.
Well, Dan, I've been feeling this way about the inflation and the interest rates for a while, but for like a real long while, like a few years. So, of course, I'm amazingly early. I mean, just like when I first started trading, when interest rates were 13 or 14%, I was very bullish on the market, but I was a year and a half early, even though I was, you know, I was young and not as dumb as, you know, I was young and dumb rather than old and dumb. And all of a sudden this TLT, which is the ETF for 20-year bonds or more, used to be the Lehman, I don't know whose it is now, but so I've had my clients, we've had four trades in the last 8 weeks, made money in every single one of them. And Dan, I am so pissed off at myself. I was always just careful. I could be wrong, blah, blah, blah. It could be again. They're going to announce more money and it'll go back the other way for a while and I'll get clunked. I've made probably a quarter of what I should have made. It just buying some puts and look the other way. And it's, you know, this one, I did this 2 days ago. I did the 36.5, 36 diagonal, thinking that, okay, we'll get through this week. It was like 37.5. I figured, all right, we'll be down this week and I'll let the other guys run next week and maybe hit a double on something I don't pay very much for. I think this morning's 33. It blew through my strike like dinner through a goose, for God's sake.
Right.
You know, and I'm sitting there going, what am I doing by being careful here? I mean, this could be the opportunity of a lifetime, and I'm being careful, but that's just the way I am. You know, I wish I could change once in a while when I'm really right.
My view, and I think a lot of the views of a lot of, you know, traditionally buy-side, institutional buy-side guys, is that we're, you know, tend to be optimists. We're looking at an optimistic outlook. We're looking at growth continuing. We're looking at, you know, not a whole lot of, you know, not a major concern necessarily with inflation, but we are realizing that we are going to see continued growth as we get more vaccines and as the economic picture becomes more clear and as we get more investor confidence and more consumer confidence. You know, there's a little bit of concern with Europe, that Europe has fallen back a little because of other strains. You know, I think if we can get beyond that, then things are going to start ticking up even further. And I think there'll be even more confidence. That might be the only thing right now that is keeping people from being even more bullish. And what we're doing, you know, one other point I had made again is that this isn't over, meaning, you know, high yield, the spreads right now are tight. The average spread now is around 330 over treasuries. But we go back to 2007, pre-2008, just 1 year pre-2008. 2007, that spread was 214. So if we look at it from that point of view, we still have a ways to go. If we're trying to measure where are we in the mature part of the cycle, well, spreads could continue to tighten as they did prior to 2008. So we still have another 100-plus basis points, which is significant when we're talking about 330 dropping down at 214. That, to me, says we're still fairly bullish on corporate bonds. And, again, I'd stay in the short end. You know, we talked before about a couple of names like SHYG, short-term high-yield ETF, or VSCH, which is Vanguard Short-Term Investment Grade, or even the EMSH, which is a short-term emerging market ETF, SHYD, which is a short-term high-yield municipal, and then we talked last time, I think, also about HYZD, which is a zero-duration high-yield. So there's more juice to come out of those spreads, if you will. There's more alpha in that sector. But those are the ways to play it, staying on the short end, trying to, you know, hedge out the duration. I mean, get rid of the duration, because that could be a concern, especially in the near term. I think it could be a concern in the long term.
I would agree. Kind of live through it, and it's very difficult to even figure out the rapidity at which these rates can change. I'm looking at in 1980, right? The national debt was $871 billion. All right, so not even a trillion, so 1/30th of what it is now. So the debt per taxpayer was $10,000 instead of like 200 or hell is now. I'll get the exact number. But when your rates went from, you know, 6 where they normally were for the 10 years, or 5 or 4, where the hell it was, to essentially, I think the 10-year got to, I know the 30-year, the 30-year bond that was traded at the Board of Trade, the specific bond that was traded was an 8.5% bond, and the low tick was like 66.5. So where does that put it? 12-5, something like that. So at 12-5, the government was able to, our government, was able to handle the, so your debt was, at the worst year, they probably got up to where it was $50-60 billion, and they were, and they were sniveling big time about that and couldn't wait to get it back down, right? But now, if we go to an average of 4%, and we're talking about almost a $30 billion hit, I mean, we're talking 120, what are we talking, $120 billion a year? In interest rate. I mean, what are we doing? I mean, the risk here, if these guys bleep up, is dramatic. They don't seem to show it at all. And the questions, I didn't hear anybody, I didn't listen to the whole thing because I can't stand the guy. Did anybody ask the bleep, the chairman of the Fed instead of the bleep, why he stopped giving out weekly money supply reports and where he's getting his numbers, and the solution now is to not give people the numbers? Did anybody ask that question? I have not heard one person on any of these alleged finance shows that have turned into just, I don't know what they've turned into, but they're not finance shows anymore. They just let people on to talk about their products and their stock and basically tell everybody to buy it, which is absurd to me. But did anybody even ask that question anywhere along the line? Hey, how can we start again? Same time we're saying don't worry about inflation, we're dumping the money supply numbers. I mean, duh. I mean, I don't know. I guess I'm the only person who looks at this. I shouldn't even talk about it. But
no, I think there were actually a couple questions that were leading in that direction that were sort of put off. I will get back to you. And you're right that normally those questions would be answered in a discussion like this. It's that those are, it doesn't want to seem to be any absolutes. You know, this seems to be more of a wait and see approach. And I don't know sometimes if that's just sort of protecting yourself. I don't know if the sort of shift, if you will, is just temporary, or whether the shift is just going to be the way it is for a while now, whether it be with the Fed or with some companies, like I said earlier, that have been sort of doing the same sort of dance around their earnings and what they're looking for in the future, or they're kind of avoiding people who are, like us who've spent our whole careers trying to look forward, and investments are all about the future, from today looking forward, rather than being reactive, being more proactive. So I think there are some challenges to that, and you have to read through some of that, and I think you have to stick to your own beliefs and still have your own opinions about these things, because getting caught up with words coming from anybody. There's nobody that has all the right answers, or is going to give you all the right information, or going to give you the information that's accurate. So what we do that I really like is I talk to, all day long, we're talking to CEOs of businesses. We get a wide variety of discussion going on about a wide variety of things, but we always go to the macro and we talk about the industry. And that information is really invaluable, because these guys are the ones that are down there, that are seeing this day to day. They're in the trenches. They're the ones who are experiencing this day to day. So if there's some global news we're hearing about, manufacturing in China, I just ask a handful of guys that we deal with, what are you seeing? And then I kind of make my own decision based on taking all this information in. But I do agree with you. There are some things that are being left out that are important.
Well, Dan, for what you do, we've talked for every week for a long time now, so I'm getting a feel, and I'm actually amazingly jealous of you, the fact you actually get to talk to these firms and so forth like that. But I get the feeling, because obviously we were doing some business together, and I wouldn't do that if I didn't think you guys were really good. The pressure that's on you personally and anybody in your business, and really anybody in mine, the pressure is much bigger than it ought to be. I mean, you're busting your tail to find the firm that people are thinking are a little, they think they're risky, and you're gonna find out they're not as risky as they are, as people think they are. So the actual 6% they're paying, which doesn't look good, actually is good because it's a real company. But you know in your heart of hearts, in a normal world, in equilibrium, that firm should be paying 8, right? Or 7.5 or something. So you have to make sure now, I mean, I'm not going to call you, what's the guy's name? Who are the toupee? What the hell's his name? Invented the junk bonds. The places you find the interest rates should be, if they're not investment grade, the interest rate should be 10 or 11%. So if Dan Genius, despite his best efforts, out of 50 places, you clunk on three of them, you're still okay. Because guess what? You're getting more money than the risk-free rate, so you can absorb it. That's the whole idea of less than investment right. grade. But was it? But now, I'm going to say if you find 10 of them and one of them you totally bleep up on, you got a problem because they're only paying five or six, you know, and when they should be paying more. I mean, same thing with me. If I looked at a couple of stocks yesterday, Crowd and Coop. I don't even know what these people do. The Crowd has something to do with cloud, I mean, computing and stuff. But damn, they're eight. The things they're trading, you know, the revenue is $8 a share, and the stocks are trading two something. If I put my people in 10 of those things, and one of them runs down to $30, I'm never going to make up for it on the other nine. I mean, there's no way. I mean, the risk is just too high. That's why, you know, I hide behind the ETFs and I make sure I have puts on everything because there's no way on earth I'm taking your dad's money and putting 1,000 shares in Crowd for 270G, whatever the thing is, and next week be having 70,000 in your dad when he's not even working saying, hey, what the hell? Because I can't do that. I mean, but the risk just seems to be so dramatic in some of this stuff. I mean, or am I just being old and foggy here?
No, it's not only dramatic. It's the timing of it that's dramatic as well. It's just it could flip on a, you know, we could have like some news that comes out one day that may not even be directly relevant that ends up having a material impact. So yeah, that's why I do think doing our extra homework makes a big difference. Knowing the companies well, you know, having been in the business for 35 years and watching trends and these particular names, trying to right now actually staying out of the more liquid names makes sense because we are in a period where there's so much liquidity. It's okay to invest in the less liquid names that are trading at decent levels, but at some point, you know, as there becomes fewer and fewer ideas, you have to really start rotating into some other areas that are going to give you more protection. I mean, we talked before about like floating rate notes as having a, you know, an area of somewhat of protection or an area, you know, that could do quite well if short rates tick up because you're not, you know, you get rid of a lot of that interest rate risk. So staying in some floaters, staying in some senior bank loan debt, those would be some safe places to park some cash where you don't have a lot of downside. So yeah, I mean I view that as a big part of our job being risk managers, trying to manage that risk. And
if the world was normal,
we know the companies, the more we know the businesses, the more we follow the trends in the stock and the investor base that participates in those stocks and bonds, the better, you know, the better we perform.
Well, the thing that the 80s taught me was that things don't stay out of equilibrium forever. And when all of a sudden they come the other way, they can come with a violence that you can't even imagine. I mean,
right.
I mean, if we're talking, say I'm totally wrong or early as usual in this 1.7 rate this morning or 1.74 is say 2.5 by Thanksgiving, all these bonds are going to drop what? 20%? 15%? That's a real number.
Yeah.
That's a real number. I mean, there's going to be people looking at their accounts going, hey, what the hell? And I'm going to say, that you're gonna, by all the work you're doing, your guys are gonna get hurt. Well, they won't get hurt at all if they're short term, which most of your guys are, but the guys you snuck out a little bit, when everybody else is losing 20%, you're gonna lose 5. Which is a spectacular job, right? But it's still not winning. Right?
I mean, we've actually done well the past year. We're up 23.5% over the trailing 12 months. And even this year, like what I mentioned earlier, you know, government's up, 4%, global ag down 3.6%. We're up 2%, so we're not, you know, we're trying to manage with an absolute return strategy where we're trying to stay out of negative territory, and I think right now it's possible.
Like I said, you've done yeoman's job. I mean, that's why. I mean, I love learning from you, but what's going to happen, I think, Dan, not just to you, maybe a little bit because your clients might demand it, probably will to me, is if the 10-year gets to like 2.5, somebody's going to say, that's good enough. And a year later, it's going to be 3.5, and $100 he just spent for the 2.5 is going to be trading 85 in his account, and he's going to, what happened to my $15?
Right. No, I hear you. There's got to be some point where it starts looking more attractive. And certainly that point's going to come sooner with, I think, foreign governments and, you know, there's going to be other investors in there sooner. The people that have to buy it, you know, the funds and the ETFs that have to buy, 10 years. And it's, you know, we'll continue to sit on the side as long as we have an alternative to making, some yield and keeping the risk, minimal if you have to look at overall risk, including interest rate risk.
We got a dash jam. I got one quick question. If the European rate ever makes it to 1%, how much of a hit, even though they'll never tell us, is the European Central Bank going to take by buying all that crap at minus 50?
Oh, yeah. No, I agree. I agree with you on that.
We'll never know that number, will we?
We won't.
Take care of yourself, buddy. Happy day after St. Patrick's Day. SP Futures down 27. NASDAQ Futures down 221. We're still leaking. Be right back, Mr. Frank Fahey.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right
now. Well, no big stocks and jocks. I'm telling you, Mr. Matt Weber, Mr. Frank Fahey with us as well. Maybe look, we got a 770 number on these jobless claims versus a 700 estimate. That's not so good. See if you get the continuing number with it, because that's not on my headline page here. S&P Futures down 2450. We were up last night. We had a nice rally after the Fed chairman spoke, and last night we were off to the races, really, certainly in gold and silver and everywhere. Now everything's down this morning, pretty much, except for, well, interest rates are not down, but the bonds are down as well. Dow Futures are down 19 because we got some stacks here. Goldman Sachs, is there going to be even more Fed buying and selling through them? They're up $4 to J.P. Morgan. I just love it when those guys make a lot of money. It's always really good for the rest of us. I just always feel that way. I don't know why. I just want those guys making more dough. DAX up 130.9%, sets at a record. FTSE down 17.2%, CAC around up 1, call that flat. I'm not sure exactly why the DAX is doing that, but it's off to the races. Nikkei, these guys must have closed before we turned around. They're up 302. That's 1%. The Shanghai up 17.5%. Hang Seng up 371. That's 1.3%. Just as a review, because it's hard to tell day to day, your Dow was up 189 yesterday, S&P up 11, and NASDAQ up 53. So we had a bullish day. The Fed chairman did not screw up when he was speaking. He allayed the fears of the market. How's that, Manny? Bonds, but here's the number of the day. 1.74 is the number. We're up almost 10 basis points, 0.097. The Bund minus 0.26 as it's creeping towards zero. It's still a ways away. Japan is not rising. It's right where it was, 0.10. So they led the rally, and now they're stable while we're rallying on interest rates. Oil down 74 cents now, 63.86. That's down 60 cents since last break. Brent down 78 cents, 67.22. Natural gas down 2 cents, 2.50. RBOB unchanged at 204. And gold, it had a big rally last night. Now it's only up 70 cents. It was up like 25 hours last night. Silver up 15 cents. It was up 65 or 70. Copper unchanged. And we've got crypto, Bitcoin down 19 bucks, 57.839, so kind of flat there as well. Maddie, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
38 minutes past the hour. Good morning once again to everyone out there. We have a couple of crashes now. All of a sudden, Chief, inbound Bishop Ford, just before 115th Street, there was a semi versus a car crash. We think the semi won that one, but the semi hit the overpass, and there's now debris all over the road, and it's causing significant delays on the inbound Bishop Ford. The accident itself has been moved to the right shoulder, but there's crews on the scene working to get the debris cleaned up, so expect delays.
It wasn't like cattle or anything like that, was it?
It doesn't say. But
or beer. We've all run down there, but it was
well,
beer.
Beer, yeah, we may go down, especially green beer.
Yeah.
But that's a big concern on the south side. It's not affecting the inbound Ryan past that, but I-57 is not moving very smoothly either. We also have an issue on the Stevenson. This crash has been moved to the right shoulder inbound side just before I-294, which is exit 277A. There was a crash, so expect delays on the inbound Stevenson as well. Meanwhile, on the Eisenhower, lots of red, slow travel times coming inbound on I-290, no accidents to report. Kennedy, traffic building steadily as you approach the circle, but no accidents. Outbound side looking okay until you get near O'Hare. Eden's looking good at this hour. Lakeshore Drive is quiet in both directions. Off the expressways, a couple of crashes out in the western suburbs. Liberty Drive on the eastbound side between Wheaton Avenue and Hale Street is closed due to utility work, and that's causing some delays. Just northeast of there, North Avenue at Glen Ellen Road, there is a crash. And then that's it for accidents. Weather today, lots of clouds, high winds with gusts as high as 40 miles per hour today. We'll also have some more rain later on. A high of just 42, and then we start to warm up a little bit on Saturday, but today it's going to be kind of a miserable late winter, early spring day with cold temperatures, high winds, rain, and a high of 42. Right now it's overcast and 39 degrees downtown. For our Phoenix listeners, partly cloudy skies with a high of 82 today. Right now it's clear and 49. In sports, Bulls blew a big second-half lead, surrendering a 17-0 run to the Spurs down in San Antonio, and then ultimately losing to the Spurs, 106-99. Tough loss for the Bulls after they'd won a couple in a row.
Their fans in San Antonio or no?
I think there's partial fans, yeah. Blackhawks were off last night. They're down in Tampa tonight to take on the Lightning. That's a 6 p.m. Chicago time puck drop. And the first four of the NCAA tournament tips off later on this afternoon. Two 16-seed games and two 11-seed games to play into the rest of the field. Texas Southern and Mount St. Mary's get the action started at 4:10 p.m. Central Time, followed by Drake and Wichita State. The Drake Bulldogs are a slight 2-point favorite over Wichita State. That's an 11-seed play-in. That's at 5:30. At 7:40, the other 16-seed matchup, Appalachian State versus Norfolk State. And then the nightcap is a 9 o'clock tip-off, actually 8:57 p.m. Central Time. Michigan State, 2-point favorites over UCLA. That should be a good one. Chief?
Well, sure, if I'm one of those guys, I really hope I'd be playing Saturday, not tomorrow.
They're all the play-in winners are Saturday.
Okay, nobody's tomorrow?
No, no, God, no.
Well, I mean, I thought there would be one in each bracket, but all the...
No.
Oh, okay.
It's two 16s and two 11s, and then you play in it to go on Saturday.
I mean, if you're a 16 and you got to play the number one tomorrow, that would be pretty tough.
Yes, it would.
But Frank, how are you, bud?
Excellent.
What's the?
It is windy out there, though.
Yeah, and when I was at Maddie's talking about the truck trailer with the debris, I never got this job. Of course, I don't know if I'd want to go. There were different sort of dudes that were in the truck dock, shall we say. But those guys would love it if there was a wreck somewhere, or, you know, the guy landed in the ditch or whatever. Say it was in Iowa or Nebraska, you got like double time from when you left the place. And maybe they'd send out another trailer, you know, one guy riding the truck and the other three guys that happened in the car. And they'd run out to the side of the road and they'd have the rooms paid for, all you could drink at the bar, and they'd unload the trailer out there, which had to be nasty work in the ditch beside the road. And load up the new trailer, and then off you'd go. But the guys loved doing it. They made a lot of dough, and I'm sure they drank them dry at the bar afterward. But we were Illinois-California Express. I'll bet even you, Frank, could figure out where we went to.
I do know. And I worked for a trucking company on the docks, too.
It was interesting work.
Third shift. PIE, Pacific Intermountain Express.
Those guys, they had the world's worst. Those drivers that drove that thing, when I used to go skiing, I'll diverge here for a second. They used to have rules, well, maybe they still do some places, on the length of the units, Matty. So some states you could bring 245-footers behind the other states you had to use pups. Illinois, you had to use pups. And with the 22-footers, if you wanted to have two trailers behind the cab. But they had overall length, so it means the big, huge cabs you see now, like with the sleepers and all that stuff, you could never use those with before because of the overall length requirement. And so everybody had those, they used to call them cab overs. You can't even see those things anymore, where the front of the truck was just like a wall. And the ones that PIE used were the world's skinniest cabs, where half the engine was out of the back of the thing, right, Frank?
And
the poor driver.
He tilted the whole truck forward.
And the poor driver.
They had to work on it.
Oh, yeah, poor driver, man. He's sitting there, and from windshield to back window, couldn't have been more than maybe what, Frank, 4 feet? So the guy is literally sitting right on top of
on the deluxe wheel. Model.
Yeah, the guy's sitting right on top of the front wheel, no sleeper, no nothing. And it was close coupled, which means that the trailer was right up against the back of the cab, or the tractor unit, which you don't want. You like the further back you are, the better the thing rides. Those poor guys bouncing out across I-80. PIE had like the worst trucks, and they all had those skinny little cab overs, the poor guys dragging doubles behind them. And I used to really feel for those dudes. Just saying. Talk about a history.
Well, I'm just saying, it's a small wonder we have bad backs at our age.
Oh yeah, Well, my brother Dan
didn't have any lift trucks.
Well, my brother Dan, they had lift trucks, and he became a Jeep driver, and we got 5 cents more an hour because he was a Jeep driver. I was a big guy, so I never got to be a Jeep driver. I just had to haul the stuff. But the weird part, before you had paper, I mean, literally, they went from Illinois, California. Denver was like the hub, so they had paper to go from Illinois to Colorado. You couldn't drop anything off or pick anything up in Iowa or Nebraska, just in Colorado. And then you could go from there to California or to Phoenix. Those are the only places they went, and you couldn't stop in Nevada and do anything there. And that was the way the paper was. So if you had a shipment to somewhere in, like, Utah, you had to drop it off in Denver, and another company that had paper from Colorado to Utah would take it to Utah.
It was heavily regulated.
Oh, yeah, it was totally regulated. And it was just a bizarre world. I mean, but the guys who worked on the docks were, even Maddie, I don't think you could get into this, but, I mean, I used to work the third shift, and then on weekends I'd work the second shift. The third shift was if you were a loner in the middle of the night, which at 2 in the morning I can be somewhat of a loner, which I'm not the rest of the time, the road trucks would pull in at like 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, and you'd get your road truck. So my job was to unload a 45-footer and take it from that truck to all the spots in the city trucks. There'd be like 15 city trucks, north, south, southwest. And then the other guys, the city trucks, would come back at 5:30, and then from 6:30 to 12, that shift, you would load up the road trucks, and those guys would take off, and the other guys would come in and I'd unload that one. So there was a choreography to it. So you basically had your truck in the middle of the night. But I never got used to eating lunch at, was it 3:30 or 4? I mean, how the hell can you be hungry at 4 in the morning, even if you're working? And then at 8:30, these guys would say, okay, we're going to the bar and like have some dinner, and then we're going home, going to bed. And I'm like, no, I can't go drinking at 8:30 in the morning. But they all did. That becomes your life, Frank. I mean, your 24 hours is just different than anybody else's.
Yeah, I was third shift, too. I had no problem eating at any time.
Well, that's why Chicago was shift work. There were guys that got off at 12, right? And other guys went to work at 12. So the guys at 12, they went to the 4 o'clock bars, and the guys in the morning went to the, whatever, 7 o'clock bars. So, I mean,
and basically, it was just a shed. They tore down the last of them, like down on Harlem across from Mariano's.
Yep. Well, the trucks you walked across, they were about 150 feet wide. And they had big things in the middle with the, you know, cordoned off in yellow lines. The stuff that, you know, was waiting in that area with stuff to go to Denver, and the other stuff was. But it was, you worked your tail off. And it was, you know, I still
it was
like.
A good job. It was
paid a lot of money.
$3.95 an hour for me in South Bend in 1970.
Well, by the time I went to grad school, I think we were up in Chicago because we were Teamsters.
I think we were Teamsters too.
I think we were up to like 9, And then I'd work Friday nights and then come back on Saturday. So I got double time on, or time and a half on Saturday. So I was making like 300 hours on a weekend when I was going to grad school, which was, but the best was, maybe they had a trucker's magazine, newspaper, whatever it was. But guess what the obituary column was called?
What?
Silent Wheels. The wheels aren't turning. The guy's going, you know. All right, Frank, enough of that.
I do it to you every time.
I know. The Fed, did you listen to your man yesterday? What are we doing here? And what does it mean for the market? We were up huge last night. And I've got, you know, big positions of my clients in gold and silver. And they were up so much last night, they were blowing through my strikes. Now this morning, they're down, for God's sake. How do we go from gold being up like $70 last night or 50 to being like unchanged this morning? All of a sudden, this is not inflationary or what?
Nobody knows anymore. Yeah, it's definitely inflationary. It's what's going to cover the inflation. I mean, Bitcoin was up and now it's down too.
Yeah.
And then there's no correlation between the different equity indexes. This is wacko.
What do you make of these stocks that are? What do you make of the stocks that are trading like, you know, 40 and 50 times revenue now? These cloud companies, they're the dot bombs of today. I mean, I can't imagine them. What the economy would have to look like for those people to be making, you know, to be 10 times earnings or something. I mean, they're to be making $25 a share or $20 a share. I mean, I don't see that's anywhere near on the drawing board any place. Do you?
No. No, I mean, I'm looking at GameStop, 215 again.
Well, the weird part about GameStop, and please don't even, I have a couple of clients that are
teasing. Please don't trade it.
Well, I have guys that
are
doing it.
There.
I've got guys that are doing it, and you know what? I can't even, as much as I try, we're guys with like, I'm going to say, you know, real accounts, Frank. Where the hell's the thing at? It's trading 215 today. And I think one of my guys sold on Monday morning, sold like the 700 calls for $3.50 or something. He sold like a 3-lot. I mean, he could, you know, it's not a lot, but still, it's a naked call. And we very rarely anybody do that. But Frank, it's hard. It's sort of hard to argue. I mean, as long as you keep it slow. I mean, I never do that. I don't do it on my own account. But I mean, at some point, you know, you sit there and go, is this thing really going to triple by Friday? I mean, really? I mean, it could with the way things are going now. But it seems like if you had a $500,000 account, it sure looks to me like $1,000 a week, even though I would never. I mean, the first thing I did was argue with the guy and said, you don't really want to do that, do you? He goes, what do you mean? Last week he got $8 for him.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Well, we used to call that on the floor when volatility was in the moronosphere.
Well, what happens is when people talk about, you know, this is the part about volatility that I can talk to them blue to the face, but it doesn't matter. All the young guys know way more than me about this stuff, or at least they think they do. They don't understand that volatility is the second derivative of the curve. It's not stock prices going up and down where there's somewhat of stock's not going to go to the sky and it can't go below zero, but the volatility, it just comes down to the point where how many people want insurance and other people can't sell them anymore. And there's nothing that says your VIX can't go from, you know, 15 to 30 is a real big deal. If it goes to 40, it's probably a sell, probably. But if all of a sudden we run into a problem, it could be 140, Frank, and there's just no, at that point, there isn't a seller anywhere. It's a different product.
Well, most of the time these moves are ephemerals. They're very short-lived.
Right. Yes.
But when it isn't, it takes people out. It tears your face off.
Yeah, and you have no. It's not like it's a stock where you can say, "Hey, it's 80. It's not going to go to 160. It's worth $2." I mean, it may go to 160, but you know the direction at some point is coming the other way. But literally, it's people buying insurance with the sun coming over or the fire coming over the top of the hill, and there just isn't a seller, and you can't. It's very difficult to impart that to people. I know Russell goes out and has given millions of seminars, and he tells people the difference between the VIX and a regular stock, and just nobody wants to hear it. I mean, they just don't. And
I have people that tell me they trade the VIX, and I'll say, what do you trade? And they said, oh, the VIX. Well, you and I both know that's a cash index. You can't trade it. The amount of lying in our industry by retail people is mind-boggling.
Well, you either trade the futures or you trade the options. You can't trade the cash. You're right.
Well, you hear people talk that way.
Well, sure. But I think what happens, Frank, is that I don't know how they think this is that people who want to sell the 400s, right, to do it like naked, probably no clearing firm is going to let you do it. So people turn around and buy the 700s and say, okay, you see I'm spread. There's a lot of room between 400 and 700. When I do stuff like that, I always sell spreads, okay, so you know just what your risk is. But I don't think I've ever sold a 300-hour spread, Frank. It called it a spread of you. I mean, what kind of spread is that, for God's sake?
That's because we were taught to look at the risk first when we look at a position or strategy. How much can I lose? Because we wanted to be in business the next day. And we never said, well, that could never happen, because you and I have seen it happen.
The term on the trading floor...
look at reward first. Look how much I can make.
Yeah, well, the term on the floor was what? Never is a long time. but you were I think a couple years after me coming to the floor. Would you ever were involved in the sell the 280s and buy a Mercedes thing in the IBM?
That was right after I was there.
Yeah, it was actually 78, so it was 2 years before.
Hey, I heard lots of sayings. Pete Schulte and I were coaches. Boo and IBM clerks.
Oh, God.
500,000 shares a day, 500 spoos is nothing.
This coach was out of control. We had him on as a guest one day. God, was he spectacular.
Oh, yeah.
He's one of the funniest guys I've ever... That's the guy, Maddie, who was when he was the offensive line coach at Wisconsin or in Illinois.
Purdue.
He was at Purdue.
But he was, I think he was somewhere... But didn't he play at Illinois? Anyway, this was the idea when they went to play Wisconsin at home and they had the red jerseys. All his offensive linemen wore red gloves, the same shade as the jersey at Wisconsin. You couldn't tell if anybody was holding. I mean, only coach would
take. And then they changed the rule so you couldn't do that.
Yeah, it was like the Doug Redman rule. but I remember, you know, the deal was IBM, it was trading, you know, it was only 100 and some stocks and there were no indexes. So if you traded the market, you thought the market was going up, you bought IBM, right? That was like the bellwether. Maybe you bought GM or something, but there really wasn't, unless you knew a specific stock. I mean, now if you think the market's going up, you buy the Spiders, or you used to buy the OEX, or you buy the E-Minis, right? Well, IBM had never closed over 280, and yet the calls always had value. So what people literally would do, the saying was, you know, Mercedes-Benz was like 50 grand at the time, or 40 or something. Probably was less than that. But guys would go, and they'd figure out, okay, I want to buy... this Mercedes would say 40 grand, then I got to sell how many of these calls to get it to 40 grand? And they'd say, oh, by the way, I need a radio, so that's another two calls, you know, type of thing. And in one week, get a load of this, Manny, on Tuesday morning they were offered at a 16th, a teeny, as we used to say. People didn't buy them in. And by Friday night they were $16.50. And these guys, instead of getting their Mercedes, got basically their ass kicked. But the weird part was they had the ability to buy them in at a 16th, which is, you know, 6.25 cents, right, which is pretty cheap. And but Frank, I'm starting to not so much at the press conference yesterday, just in what people are sending me. Matter of fact, the people from the right now are taking the left swing here and saying how regular people are getting screwed on this deal. You know, how if you actually want to help the working class, you could divide the 100 million people that are the working class into the amount of money and send everybody a $19,000 check, and you just help the entire working class and not send anybody else anything. But you know, that's not going to happen, ever. You know, I mean, talk about trickle up. Nobody wants to do trickle up. But right, even the people who are looking the other way realize that this is a change. I mean, we've gone from no inflation to maybe some, to maybe it's transitory, to we don't care. I mean, that's pretty quick in a few months. I mean, when are we going to start getting somewhat of a cry of where are we going with this? I mean, is it ever coming or what?
You mean beyond you and me?
Yeah. Well, damn, everybody on the show sort of feels the same way. To a certain degree.
I mean, it's happening. I mean, my oat milk went from a 64-ounce container to a 52-ounce container.
Does that mean they feed cows oats and they give oat milk or what?
Well, you probably can't call it that in the EU, but yes, And milking oats is hard.
I don't even know how you go about doing that. Why do you have oat milk? Just out of curiosity, what does that do to you? Is it like spinach for Popeye?
It's plant based energy.
Oh, all right.
It's low fat.
Right. It's taken over.
What does it do to me? It makes my wife happy.
All right. Why is it? Is it better than soy milk?
I've heard it's much better than soy milk and some of the other milk substitutes.
It's much better than almond milk because almond milk requires a boat ton of water to grow almonds.
Really?
Yes.
Well, we got nothing but water. We got nothing but water here. The whole place is flooding.
Just saying. In the Midwest, yeah. Yes.
All right, Frank. You always bring something interesting to the table. Now it's oat milk. All right, bud. I'll have to chew on that one before I see you on Monday. S&P futures down 25. NASDAQ futures down 217. Back tomorrow, stocks and UX.
What did we learn, Palmer?
I don't know, sir.
I don't know either. I guess we learned not to do it again.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex. Offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit HamzyAnalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.